Hello and a very warm welcome to Political Economy with Shweta Kunj. We're about a week away from general elections, and as campaigning hits a new crescendo, there's talk of wealth redistribution being implemented in India. This is 2024. We are talking about general elections in the year 2024. And very recently, almost as early as last week, we heard the Congress Party, one of India's largest opposition parties, say that if voted to power, they will conduct a financial and institutional survey to ascertain who is in possession of the wealth of the country and would then undertake an exercise to redistribute the wealth. Mr. Rahul Gandhi has promised a representation of each community in every sector. He reiterated his idea for India, which is Jitni Abadi Utna Hak, roughly translating into wealth will be redistributed according to the population dynamics. A nationwide caste census will be conducted to determine how many people belong to other backward castes, scheduled tribes, minorities, and so on, and accordingly wealth will be distributed. To understand what does this wealth redistribution mean and what could be its implications for India, I have with me the very erudite Rajiv Mantri, a venture capital fund investor, an entrepreneur and author of A New Idea of India. Thanks, Rajiv, for joining us today on Political Economy, on this fourth podcast, Decoding India's Biggest Policies. I just want to begin by asking you, what is, you know, when Mr. Gandhi says that there will be wealth redistribution, even though the Congress Party has presented no details of this, what is he really implying, or what does it really mean?
Thank you, Shweta, for having me on the show. So I think the big problem I see with this line of thinking is that one has to understand that you can't make poor people rich by making rich people poor. And the kind of so-called redistribution which is being talked about and raked up by some of the opposition figures, it is actually very disturbing to see that in 2024 we are hearing a rhetoric which would befit the Chinese Mao era of the 60s, or for that matter something that India also went through in earlier decades. And frankly, none of those policies worked, and in the 1990s, we decided to move on from that. So when somebody suggests that there should be a survey and of all the wealth and assets of the country and some kind of redistribution, to me, that appears to be like a grab of property of individuals who would have fairly earned that property and asset. Yeah. And is that where we want to go? I mean, is that how we are going to make India a developed country? Is that how we are going to become a 10 trillion economy and beyond? To my understanding and knowledge, absolutely not.
So from what I gather, you know, what Mr. Gandhi is obviously also probably hitting out at is the fact, is this whole argument about increasing inequality in the country. And that's probably why the idea might appeal to a certain section of people that wealth needs to be redistributed. We've seen the income gap between various classes rise. But is this the right way to go about it, Rajiv?
No, so I know there's a lot of discussion on this. I think everyone likes to focus on the, 80, 90 new billionaires. No one wants to talk about the 200 million or 300 million people who have escaped poverty. How many people have escaped poverty in the last 10 years? Let's take account of that. And I think there have been credible papers and studies that have been put out by even, independent economists, which are estimating the number at north of 250 million people. So an escape from poverty obviously is not discussed, but certain vested interests only want to fixate on, who has how much wealth and how that wealth can be grabbed further. I think that is a very unhealthy kind of a dynamic for an economy which wants to become a more market-based economy. A more market-based economy means we have to respect property rights. Obviously, having said that, we have a very large degree of progressivism in our taxation system. So we already have a situation in India where those who are wealthy, those who are high income earners, they are paying north of 35-40% income tax at an individual level. We also have a highly progressive GST system, which is quite unusual, actually. In most countries, there are two or three, actually not even three, usually one or two bands of the GST rates. In our country, we
Which is actually the right way to go about it, but we have so many to address different different income brackets. And
So India has elected to go for progressivism even in indirect taxes. So there are certain types of sin goods and luxury items which are classified that way by the government, and those are taxed at 28%. So there is a high degree of progressivism. So I feel those who are kind of throwing around rhetoric like this irresponsibly, their objective to me can only be to ignite a class war. It can't be anything.
Right. So I want to talk about that. You know, when Mr. Gandhi talks about wealth redistribution, he is implying that like you pointed out, that land, property, wealth will be taken away from wealth earners and redistributed perhaps equally, if that's what he's implying. So, you know, and you mentioned that we've seen this in the past in India, we've seen this being implemented in China. And how did that really play out? What are the lessons that history holds for us, you know, when such promises are made, and as appealing as they may sound to a certain strata of society, what are we really looking at in terms of the consequences?
No, so let's talk about the China example, right? So what Mao had done in China, essentially grabbing the assets of those who had assets, those were kind of nationalized in a way. And leaders like Mao and Pol Pot and, you know, others of the communist hue, they were thinking that we are doing the morally correct and righteous thing by grabbing away people's properties. And even in the so-called redistribution, there is ample evidence across countries where, you know, this is often redistributed not to those who are at the bottom of the pyramid, but often this kind of redistribution becomes subject to a lot of corruption, because the entities which are carrying out the so-called redistribution will also something for themselves.
It's government. They will grab something for themselves.
Yeah, there will be some politicians or officials, and they will grab something for themselves.
What happened in China when Mao Zedong implemented these policies? Collectivization is what this whole program was called.
It was the collectivization of agriculture. It finished off Chinese sort of business and industry for two to three decades. Only in the 80s, they started sort of reforming. It took probably three or four generations for China to shake off the effects of that policy.
To undo the damage.
Absolutely. No, and similarly in India, we also saw a wave of this kind of asset grab by the government in the late 60s and 70s, where industries like insurance, banking, mining, they were all nationalized. So those who owned these companies, those who owned these assets, they lost everything. Today, obviously, we see that as part of the nationalized PSU system. But these were privately run enterprises. And they were run by credible figures. They were run by credible groups then and now. Those groups are still around. So to break it down,
what Mr. Gandhi is implying is, and the possible consequences of that is, one, it could kill entrepreneurship and innovation in the country, because people are motivated by driving change. People are motivated by wealth creation. It could drive away wealth creators from this country. At the moment, India is a very attractive investment destination simply because of the returns that the country is promising, its demographic dividend and so on. But it could drive away investors. India could lose its sheen as an investment destination. It could actually hurt the whole investment climate of the country. And then it could lead to social unrest, because it could, again, build a sense of entitlement. Am I right?
No. I mean, there would be that element of a class war, like I said, where you try to pit one group against the other and play on the sort of insecurities of one group and say that, you know, you are in a particular state because these people robbed you, or these people, you know, exploited you in different ways, which may not be true, actually. I mean, there are n number of genuine business owners in this country who have built their assets and built their wealth through good and proper means. I mean, they have not stolen anyone's money or, you know, pilfered money from a bank. They have built the assets the hard way over decades of work. And so to one fine day go to them and say that what is yours is no longer yours, and the state reserves the right to grab it, and so-called indulge in a so-called redistribution of those wealth and assets, that would not be legitimate. I mean, where we speak of misconduct by sort of business owners and asset owners, there is plenty of checks and balances are there today now. Where if you are actually doing something egregious or illegal to acquire properties, acquire companies, you know, build up your assets and so on, there is a lot of recourse that government as well as the entity which is being robbed from, they have plenty of recourse at this point, including the bankruptcy code, where if you try to cheat banks or don't pay back your loans that were taken from a bank, then the company owners will lose the company. That has happened on multiple occasions at this point.
Right. Which is a far cry from what it used to be earlier.
Absolutely.
I was speaking with Mr. Nilesh Shah, who was telling me that in the 80s, 70s and 80s, there would be an arranged marriage proposal. And one of the questions that would be asked was that how many times have you defaulted? Because if you defaulted, it invariably implies that you're very wealthy. You have a lot of money.
No, it was actually a fixed match. I think he's put it very well. It was actually a fixed match. So the banks, some of the big industry groups, the politicians, they were all in cahoots. And each one was watching out for the other. It was not a capitalist system as a capitalist system is supposed to run. It gave capitalism a bad name, actually, which is why there is accountability today, one of the policy measures I have been most pleased about is the bankruptcy code. We have a recourse today where those who don't pay back their dues will lose their company. I mean, there is something at risk for them now. Earlier, it was the bank which was, you know, at risk because a large borrower had defaulted and then the bank was worried about how will they make good. But now at least the bank has some recourse today.
So, Rajiv, just help me understand this. You've written the book, The New Idea of India. Where does this narrative that Mr. Gandhi is trying to stir in India right now before elections, where does this narrative really fit in? Do you think it fits in with the current, with the current idea of India and what India aspires to be?
No, so see, the challenge I see for our economy is we have a large job creation requirement. So there are millions of jobs that the Indian economy needs to generate to make sure that, you know, our large population and youth population in particular remains like gainfully employed. Now, somewhere because of a few shocks which have come in the system over the last 3-4 years, not least of all the pandemic, there could have been some challenges, right? For some regions or some sections, they have not been able to realize their aspirations. Let's put it that way. So if someone is an aggrieved party in that way, I think this kind of a toxic message can appeal to them. I think that's the constituency the opposition seems to be going after. But in a larger sense, I think it does a lot of damage because the message we are sending to not just those who are working hard in India, following the law, doing things the right way and earning their property, but even foreign investors, when they look at India, they look at a major opposition figure spouting this kind of rhetoric, it will give someone a pause that, you know, what if India is being governed not by the current dispensation, but this opposition dispensation. So will they actually start pursuing these kind of policies? And that will somewhere give somebody a pause. I think that is the bigger risk, actually. That is where the damage is done.
So Rajiv, you know, we did speak about the the inequality, the rising inequality in India. And like I said, that maybe Mr. Gandhi is trying to attack that through this whole wealth redistribution idea. You know, in terms of our policies, how can we look at addressing that rising inequality, because it is a problem. We've seen huge wealth disparity, and you know, what is the right way of going about it? And as someone who advises investors, in fact,
I would even challenge that. When the question of inequality comes, we have to see, you know, how is that being measured? Now, if someone looks at the stock prices or the market capitalization and then computes the wealth and then compares that wealth of a top 5% of the country with the bottom 5%, that simply doesn't make any sense. Because the bottom 5% or the bottom 10% is in a very different financial strata. They don't have the assets. So we are comparing income with you're comparing a stock with a flow. Right. And you are kind of looking at, I know there are some of these international NGO groups who keep putting out these reports every year, asserting that inequality has risen so much and so on and so forth. But I think it's a whole lot of rubbish, honestly. And the way we have to look at things is, are people getting a chance to move up the social ladder? Is there social mobility? Is there wealth sort of mobility? And who are all these new billionaires who are coming in India? I think if someone did a study of this, they would probably find that many of them are actually first-generation entrepreneurs. They aren't people who have inherited their wealth or assets. They are mostly people who started a company, 10, 20, 30 years ago. And, they've built a company to a certain size. If they take it public, it gets in the public domain that there is a certain market value of that company. And there are dozens of such people at this point. And that's what we want more of, because these are the people who are actually creating jobs. They are the entrepreneurs. They are taking risks, frankly. For every person who's actually succeeding in that way, there are many others who are not succeeding. That is also a reality.
This is the first time that the Congress Party has proposed this idea. The Nyay scheme was completely different. Their guarantees have been completely different in terms of handing out free things. This is taking it to another level.
I do think it's the rhetoric is definitely, frankly, disturbing. We are in 2024 and we are hearing essentially the Marxist, Leninist, Maoist kind of policy ideas, which have completely failed across the world, even in India. So we don't want to go down that road and give it one more try. This only causes damage, chaos, disruption, and creates a big mess from which it can take years or even decades to get out.
So you were talking to us from Kolkata, and you were telling me about how Mr. Jyoti Basu, this reminds you of what Mr. Jyoti Basu used to say in West Bengal.
Absolutely. I was very young actually when the worst of that was happening. But even before I was born in the 70s and 60s, we all know the story of Calcutta, right? Like, it used to be the business hub of the country, the commercial capital. And over the decades, it's lost its position. So the question is why? Because the reason is that the state government here has driven away business, and it has adopted, as well as in a policy way, implemented the same ideas that are being talked about by other parties now. So the CPM very much did this. The left front government, they would sort of hound certain types of industry groups. They drove away business. They were against they claimed to be kind of pro-labor, but they were anti-employment.
Pro-labor, but anti-employment. What a
anti-employment. They were against jobs being created. Their objective was that everyone should join the government, join the party, immerse their entire existence into a certain political milieu of the leftist way. And that was frankly very toxic for society here.
So I want to go back to the point that you had raised that, you know, this if wealth redistribution were to happen, it will be state actors who will be responsible for this, which would lead to corruption. Exactly. Famously, Mr. Rajiv Gandhi had said, right, that.
Who's going to get this? How will it this be developed? Right? I mean, first of all, honestly, I don't think it is even constitutional, because in our constitution, we are guaranteed some property rights, right? I mean, some political party, no matter what they say, they cannot change that. Thank God for that. Actually, we should not just thank the gods. We should thank many lawyers, thinkers who have put this in our constitution and fought for it over the years, great people like Mr. Nani Palkhiwala, who was a renowned constitutional expert. He was a senior counsel and a very eminent lawyer, as well as a business leader. He was a director with many of the Tata companies for decades. So his whole life, actually, he was an advocate for property rights, for liberty, for freedom. And I would encourage, you know, whoever is interested, they should read his writings. Because these debates are debates we've had earlier in India in the 60s, 70s, 80s. And individuals like Mr. Palkhiwala fought very, very stoutly to protect these rights.
So this, in a sense, the whole idea of wealth redistribution is talking about an all-powerful state. It is talking about taking away individual rights and liberties of owning property and so on.
Absolutely.
It is giving... It's giving extraordinary powers to the state to not only take over property, but to distribute it the way they seem fit.
No, and Mr. Palkhiwala had written this. Nani Palkhiwala wrote this in one of his books. He said that if you don't have property today, you will not have liberty tomorrow. And he made the case very strongly for why property rights are, you know, sacrosanct in a democratic setup, in if you want a liberal democratic setup, you cannot have a country which has no property rights. Frankly, there is no example of such a country which is liberal and democratic and does not have property rights. If you're working hard, if you are toiling for, you know, with your own labor and industry, you have accumulated certain savings, certain wealth, you have every right to do what you want with it. Least of all, some government or some state authority cannot come and say that today we are grabbing it and now we know what's better. I mean, frankly, that whatever wealth is there, is that has already happened in the form of taxes, right? That's a social contract. We all pay our taxes. Right. And whatever is left over, we have a right to do what we want with it. So there should be no sort of further encumbrances or intrusion into that. Least of all, somebody coming along and asserting that we will grab it and redistribute it to whoever we like.
All right. Thank you so much, Rajiv, for that. So clearly the consensus, the word from the expert here seems to be that Mr. Rahul Gandhi's idea of wealth redistribution is an audacious idea that will take back India by 3 to 4 decades, and the damage that it will do to India.
Even a toxic one. I would even say it's a toxic one. Audacious is okay if it's in a positive direction. But right. I think this is a very toxic idea and we should not subscribe to it.
Right. So it'll take back India by 3 to 4 decades. We've seen this idea play out in some other parts of the world, including India. And the end result has not been encouraging. What Mr. Gandhi is actually suggesting is an all-powerful state which compromises on the liberty and rights of individuals to own property. And that's something, as Mr. Mantri has also pointed out, is something that's not constitutional. Thank you so much, Rajiv. Great talking to you. To declutter and defog this very crucial argument. I think it's we wanted to do this podcast on this subject because we're just 10 days away from polling, and it's important for voters to be informed about what they should vote on, the issues that they should that should determine their vote. Thanks so much to all our viewers for tuning in, and for all
Thank
our
you,
listeners.
Thank you for having me.